Vishama, Buddhi, Sarva, Uteshu, Duridham, Yam, Manyase, Sadabhadram, Surhidam, Bhadram, Agya, Vat, Tave Jam Visham Buddhi, Tave Jam Visama Buddhi, Sava Bhuteshu Durhidam, Sarva Bhuteshu Duridham, Yanmanasya Sadabhadram, Yanmanyase Sadabhadram, Suridam Bhadram Agyavat, Suridam Bhadram Agyavat, Tave Jam Vishamabuddhi, Sabe Bhuteshu Buddhidham, Yanmanayase Sadbhadram, Surhidam Bhadram Ajavat, Diham, this, Visama, bias, Buddhi, attitude, Sava Bhuteshu, towards all living beings, Duridam, of those who have ill intention, Yat, that, Manasya, Manyase, you wish. Sadha, always. Abhadram, evil. Suridam, to your well wishes. Bhadram, good. Agyavat, like an ignorant person. Translation, to Rukmini, Balaram said, your attitude is unfair, for like an ignorant person, you wish good to those who are inimical to all living beings and who have done evil to your true well-wishers. Purport responsibly. To Rukmini, Balaram said, your attitude is unfair. For like an ignorant person, you wish good to those who are inimical. To all living beings, and who have done evil to your true well wishes. So there's no purport to this one. And the next verse is Atma Moha Niram Eva Kalpate Deva Mayaya Suridam Durid Udasina Iti Dasatma Manina. The Supreme Lord's Maya makes men forget their real selves, and thus, taking the body for the self, they consider others to be friends, enemies, or neutral parties. Again, no purport. So the next one is Eka Eva Para Yatma Sarvesham Apidehinam Naneva Griyate Mudhe Yata Jyoti Yata Nabha. Translation: those who are bewildered and perceive the one supreme soul who resides in all embodied beings as many, just as one perceives the light in the sky or the sky itself as many. Purport by the disciples of Srila Prabhupada, in particular Hridayananda Das Goswami Acharyadev. The last line of this text, Yata Yoti Yata Nabha, introduces two analogies in which we perceive one thing to be many. Jyoti indicates the light of the heavenly bodies, such as the sun or the moon. Although there is only one moon, we may say that the moon reflects in pools, rivers, lakes, and buckets of water. Then it would appear as if there were many moons, although there is only one. Similarly, we perceive a divine presence in each living being because the Supreme Lord is present everywhere, although he is one. The second analogy given here is yatanabha, is that of the sky. If we have a row of sealed clay pots in a room, the sky or air is in each pot, although the sky itself is one. The Srimad Bhagavatam 1.2.32 gives a similar analogy concerning fire and wood. Yatahi avito vamir duri ekas vayonisu naneva bhati vishvatma bhuteshu cha tata puman. The Lord, as the Supersoul, pervades all things, just as fire permeates wood, and so he appears to be of many varieties, although he is absolutely one without a second. Omagyanti mirandasya gananjana shalakya chakshuram militan nina tasma shri gavaya namaha Namo om Vishnupadaya Krishna Vastaya Bhutale Shimari Hridaya Nanda Goswami Niti Namine Namo om Vishnupadaya Krishna Vastaya Bhutale Shimari Bhakti Vananta Swami Niti Namine Namaste Saraswati Devam Gauravani Pacharani Nevisesha Shunivani Pashachade Shatayane. So, the Supreme Lord is everywhere. You have to excuse me today, I'm coming down with a cold or something. The last couple of days I've just been absolutely wiped out. I couldn't get up this morning and I thought, oh God, it's material body. It's an amazing thing, isn't it? It can be really a source of pleasure but extreme pain as well. So, this is a really amazing section here, just this purport. We've heard this analogy of the different areas of Krishna, how Krishna spreads himself to every living entity. There was one purport that I read recently in the Bhagavatam 5.3.17 that I just wanted to read. But Prabhupada says, in the Kali Yuga, different religious sects consider their God to be different from the God of others. But that is not possible. God is one, and he is appreciated according to the different angles of vision. So, in this day that we live in the 21st century, we see that there are so many different religious, so-called religious groups, people that are struggling for some aspect of religiosity in their life, and they really feel that their God is the only God, and that anybody else's concept of God is absolutely irrelevant. And it's so confusing. As devotees, we're given a gift to understand God in full, with no illusion and no confusion. This is a wonderful gift, because actually, people are so frustrated in their understanding of who God is. I remember when I was, back in the old days, struggling to actually find out. I think we all, as devotees, at one point of time, were considering what is actually God, you know. Where does it all fit in? Being brought up as a Christian, the concept of God was really diverse. There was just so many ideas about God, and the Bible didn't really give any particular answer as to who God is and where God resides. And you read the Bible, and if people read the Bible, there are so many sections now of the Bible which are irrelevant. And so basically you are taught to cherry pick different aspects of the Bible. Something is in favour and something is not in favour. This is always how you approach the spiritual subject matter of who is God. But a devotee has been given the gift to completely understand God. At one point in time in my history, I really became so frustrated about the whole concept of how do I get to know God, how do I get to know the Supreme Personality, that after a period of time of great delusion, in the initial stages I was interested in trying to find out, I thought, okay, well, God, as expressed to me through my teachers, could be found through compassion, could be found by teaching others about God, which is right in a sense. So at a very immature age, I decided that I would go off and be a missionary, because I thought, well, if I'm going to find out about God by trying to find God and give God to other people, that might be the way. So I went to New Guinea. It was arranged. I was 18 years old, and I went to New Guinea, and I was studying under a Christian brother, an order of Christian brothers. And I was determined I was going to, this was it, I was going to find God through this way and help people and develop my compassion for humanity and and serve these people, that these unfortunate souls that had no knowledge of God, from my perception. Anyway, I arrived there, and the priest took us in a little light aircraft over the fields of New Guinea, and there, right in the middle of this jungle, was this little hole, and that's where we had to land, and that's where the preaching was going to happen. So when I arrived there, after a very short period of time, I was quite disillusioned by what I saw. That actually the compassion that people had for the people that they were supposed to be teaching was very limited. There was an incredible amount of prejudice, and there was an incredible amount of ignorance. People really weren't in love with God, the people that were there. I can't say wholesale, but from my perception as an 18-year-old man, I just couldn't see it. They were hypocritical, they were prejudiced to these people, these simple people, these Papua New Guinean people, who were incredibly sincere, gentle souls, just loving people, devoid of so-called God consciousness, and had to be taught the Christian way. But when you made a comparison between the two people, two races, it was just incredibly obvious that the people that were trying to teach these natives had no real idea. So after a period of time, I was so peeved off with it that I said to the head principal priest that was there, I said, look, I'm sorry, but I'm catching the next plane out of here, because I just don't believe what you're doing here is correct. So he arranged that, and so I flew out of there really disillusioned. I came back to Melbourne. My mother thought it was a great thing. Oh, here was her Catholic boy, you know, gone off to the missions. He was going to be a priest. This is really far out, you know. But then a couple of months later, I'm on the front doorstep. Hey, Mum, how are you? I'm back. So that wasn't really well appreciated. She could understand. But so my search for God continued. So my friend said, look, you know, you should try these drugs. They're really... you know, they're really transcendent. This was the whole thing with Timothy Leary. All these sort of characters were saying that real spirituality, real enlightenment came from intoxication. You know, so being an art student, went down that track. Still, I found nothing. It was just like an empty shell. And I became really depressed. And then one day, this gentleman came in, a friend of mine, and he was radiant. He was also at the college that I was at, and he was radiant, he was effulgent. And somehow or other I said, my God, what are you on? You know, you look fantastic. And he said, well, I've started meditation. And I thought, that must be the answer. That's where it's at, meditation. I'd heard something about it, it must be really good. So I started this meditation that day. That day I went, dropped everything, ran out of the sculpture room, went to this lady, got taught to meditate, and gave up eating meat, stopped any sort of intoxication, and I thought, this is it. So then that was my path. That was my goal, to find God. And then what I found was that actually, through this bogus guru, I'd sort of cleansed my life up a little bit, but in actual fact, there wasn't any real knowledge of God. So again, I became frustrated and disillusioned. And I was asking this guru, you know, so who is God? And are you my guru? And he would turn around and he would say, oh, this will all come. Yeah, just be patient. Do another course and this will all come. So we were forking out money to do this course and that course, and we did TM Cities and we did this thing and that thing, and we were just paying out money. And then one time during the course, somebody gave me a little picture of Krishna, just a small picture, which we still have in our home. You know that one, don't you? And that picture of Krishna just fascinated me so much. It just enthralled me. It's such a beautiful picture of Krishna. So I asked, you know, who's this? Oh, this is Krishna. Ah, that's the Supreme Personality of God. Oh, really? Okay. And somebody gave me Prabhupada's Bhagavatam. And while I was doing this TM course, doing all this meditation and yoga asanas and pranas and all pranayamas and all that kind of stuff, I started to read the Bhagavatam. And I thought, wow, this is amazing. And all the knowledge that was contained in this one Bhagavatam was just so enthralling because it was answering my questions. So anyway, in these meditation programs, what you do is you actually have to express your experiences to the group. You know, it's sort of like a bonding thing, you know. So here we all were, you know, and they said, "So, Bert, how's your meditations going?" I said, "Oh, they're fabulous. I'm meditating and I'm feeling this presence of Krishna, you know, because I was reading the Bhagavatam, you know, and I get this vision from this little picture that I had of Krishna. He's coming in my meditations and it's really wonderful." And they all started going, "Uh-huh." You know, and that's good, Bert, you know. And one of the teachers turned around and he said, "Look, if you don't watch out, I mean, you could be chanting on the streets with the Hare Krishnas before too long." And I said to him, I remember specifically, I said, "Well, that may not be a bad idea." And from that point, a friend of mine who had given me the Bhagavatam had decided, okay, that's it. We're going to meet this person who wrote this book. He's got the answers. This Prabhupada is it, you know. No one else could give us the answers, but Prabhupada could give us the answers. That's it, we're going to meet him. So we've determined, you know. Some time before I had an opportunity to see Prabhupada, but just one of the other gurus that was coming into town, and I missed out on that opportunity. I actually even came to the Hare Krishna temple, and Prabhupada had just been here. And the devotees hadn't moved any of the paraphernalia with Prabhupada on this Vyasa San, hadn't moved anything. Everything was still there. They wanted to keep it for as long as possible. And I said, "Oh, really?" He said, "Oh, you just missed our spiritual master by 3 days. I said, "Oh, yeah, fair enough, okay." And walked out. But this time, we were in, after I'd read the Bhagavatam, and I was sitting in this yoga class in this meditation group, a friend of mine said, "Okay, that's it. We're going to see it. When he comes, he's coming in 1977. Yeah, he was supposed to come in 1977. We'll go and see him." Anyway, at the end of that rounding course, at the end of that meditation course, one breakfast, there came an announcement, and they said, "We have to inform you that His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada, the founder of the Hare Krishna movement, has passed away." And a friend and I looked at each other and said, "We missed it. We missed the train." We were so dejected. So completely lost that we'd missed the opportunity. Here we are, after early years trying to find out who's God, who's God, who's God, who's God. Praying to God, and I think we've all done that, praying to God, "Please, Lord, somehow or other tell me who you are so that I can love you, so I can reciprocate with you." Then Prabhupada had passed away. Anyway, we said we're coming to the temple anyway. Cut a long story short, here I am. We managed to find that out. So we've been given an extraordinary gift to understand God. No illusion, no confusion. There's no hidden things. There's no cherry picking. If you read the Bhagavatam or you read the Bhagavad Gita, you don't have to delete things or you don't have to coerce things. It's all there, right in front of you. The truth is the truth. So some of the truth that's explained here are some of these analogies that are made. In the Vedas, in the Mudaka Upanishad, there's also the analogy that's given. Here the analogy is given that although there's only one moon, we may see the moon reflected in pools, rivers, lakes and buckets of water. So that shows that Krishna is everywhere in all living entities. Similarly, there's that analogy that's given in the Mudaka Upanishad where Krishna and the living entity are compared to the two birds sitting on the one tree. One is the silent witness and the other one is eating the fruits of the material tree. And Krishna is that one, that bird that is witnessing. And we, as the living entity, are out there trying to enjoy the material fruits. One is a servitor, although they're friends, one is a servitor and one is the master. Another analogy, which is given also in the Svetasvata Upanishads, is this one that's mentioned here, where Prabhupada says, and it's mentioned in the Bhagavatam, "The Lord as the super soul pervades all things, just as fire permeates wood, so he appears to be many varieties, though he is the absolute one without a second." So this fire in wood is also an analogy that's given. The fire in wood is perceived in a subtle form in the wood. And it's described in this Upanishad that when they're rubbed together, when two sticks are rubbed together, this dormant fire which is in the wood manifests itself. So similarly, the point is made in this Upanishad that similarly, if one's body is the lower piece of wood, which is irony, and the simple Om or Pranav or the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra is the upper part of the piece of wood, the friction between the two, which is the dhyana or the meditation, is the action. So you've got the two sticks of wood. One is that rubbing causes the friction, which will then enable the individual to see Krishna within the heart. So this is the process. So Prabhupada also gives the analogy of milk. When you churn milk, butter comes forth. So the process, this meditation, this churning or this rubbing, is the hearing and chanting of the qualities, pastimes, and holy name of the Lord. This is what we have to do. And then the Paramatma is automatically felt. It starts to become enlivened. The Lord then is realized by oral reception. Now we had a class the other day at Hiti's place. It was Hiti's birthday, and we were talking about the mind and how to control the mind. And Prabhupada says the devotees were saying, oh, just this hearing and chanting process has to go on. Prabhupada was asked by one devotee, how do you control the mind when you're chanting Hare Krishna? Mm-hmm. Prabhupada simply said, just hearing. So often you just have to hear. Switch off the mind. Turn off the mind and just hear. Just hear the sound vibration of the holy name. That's all that is required. So if we do this properly, then super soul will become manifest to us. Now, how many people have had connection with super soul in some way? Yeah, good. Don't doubt it. It actually happens. All of us had, in actuality. All of us. Anybody that's chanted Hare Krishna, even for a little while, even for one mantra, will start to get that connection with super soul. There's no doubt about it. It has to happen. It says it here. It's like two sticks rubbing together. It's laying dormant within us. This truth, the Supreme Personality within us, becomes manifest. It's not a sahaja type of thing, but you know the presence of God. You start to feel the presence of God. You start to become satisfied that the truth is being given to you. And when this fire is ignited, when we've rubbed the sticks together, when this dhyana, this meditation process is ignited, when we're actually starting to feel super soul within, as one fire ignites, what happens? It ignites another fire, another fire, another fire. So we start igniting fires in other people. And that is an automatic symptom. How many people have had it that when you started chanting Hare Krishna, you couldn't... I remember in the first days, this was so funny, in the first days when after all this process of trying to find God and going to this group and that group, I think our crew, our friends, who were all spiritually minded, went to see every single guru that ever came to Melbourne except Srila Prabhupada, or Parikit saw Prabhupada, you know, and none of them could give us the answer, you know, so... what was I talking about? When you actually get the truth, all you want to do is pass it on to somebody else. So when we found the joy of this chanting of Hare Krishna, and when we found that divine spark, Krishna the silent witness within, becoming ignited and starting to understand and feel his qualities within us, you just wanted to pass it on to somebody else. So what we did was, foolishly, and this is sometimes what happens as a younger devotee, you want to pass it on to everybody. So we used to go to all these TM meetings, you know. Yeah. As devotees, shaved up, dhoti, kurta, da-da-da, and these people would be presenting in the city, in East Melbourne. At that stage, TM was a huge thing. Maharishi, the whole thing was a huge thing. We would go, rock up, tilak on, and sit in the back of the lecture where they were doing this introductory lecture, you know. And the guy would be totally intimidated, you know. Because by this stage, there was like, how many of us were there? I think there was about 8 in total, TMers, at that stage. We all just, holus bolus became Haris, you know. And Maharishi actually banned anybody to have any association with us, and we weren't allowed to, that people weren't allowed to go to Gopals, the TMers weren't allowed to go to Gopals. Don't talk to Bhakta, don't talk to Parika, don't talk to any of these guys that have swung over to the Haris. But we used to go to their meetings where they're trying to recruit and get new people in, right? So there's this bunch of Haris sitting at the end of the hall, and the guy would tentatively give his speech about meditation and how it gives you better sense gratification and all this kind of stuff. And you just have to pay $2,000 or $3,000 and so on and so forth. And what happened was, you know, at the end we would be putting up our hand, you know. But, you know, and they would be completely rattled. We gave that up after a period of time. But you have such a passion to actually pass this on to others. So this dormant love of God, this supreme personality of Godhead, which is within all of us, is dormant within each of us. And we want to know the truth. And truth is in us all. So we have to utilize our intelligence to understand this truth. Kayami. We're asking all the time, who am I? Who is the Supreme? Who do I surrender to? So every living entity is always connected and has to the Supreme and has a certain amount of intelligence. An animal has a certain amount of intelligence. A living entity, even a microbe, has a certain amount of intelligence, and that directs it in its life the way it has to go. But a human has the intelligence to inquire about their real identity, who we really are. If we don't, then technically speaking, we're no better than an animal. If we don't make inquiries as to who we are, then we're no better than an animal. Because some of my friends who were also at art college just couldn't understand where my direction was going. And unfortunately, those people are still in the same predicament. We tried to give them prasadam, so they've got some benefit. But actually, if you're not making inquiry about who we really are, you're practically no better than an animal. And there was one purport that I just wanted to read out of the Bhagavad Gita in 15:15. You know that one, Sarvasya Chaham Hridi Sunni Visto. There's a little purport that Prabhupada gives, if I could just read this out, which is so pertinent to this section. Sarvasya Chaham Hridi Sunni Visto Mata Spriti Agyanam Apoanam Chavedas Chave Aham Eva Vedyo Vedanta Krit Veda Vid Eva Chaham. I'm seated in everyone's heart, and from me comes remembrance, knowledge, and forgetfulness. By all the Vedas I am to be known. Indeed, I am the compiler of Vedanta, and I am the knower of the Vedas. This is the purport section that I just... The Supreme Lord is situated as Paramatma in everyone's heart, and it is from him that all activities are initiated. The living entity forgets everything of his past life, but he has to act according to the directions of the Supreme Lord, who is witness to all his work. Therefore, he begins his work according to his past deeds. Required knowledge is supplied to him, and remembrance is given to him, and he forgets also about his past life. Thus the Lord is not only all-pervading, he is also localized in every individual heart. He awards a different fruit of results, and he is not only worshipable as the impersonal Brahman, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and the localized Paramatma, but as the form of the incarnation of the Vedas as well. The Vedas give the right direction to the people so that they can properly mold their lives and come back to Godhead, back to home. The Vedas offer knowledge of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Krishna. And Krishna in his incarnation as Vyasadeva, is the compiler of Vedanta. The commentation on the Vedanta Sutra by Vyasadeva in the Srimad Bhagavatam gives the real understanding of the Vedanta Sutra. The Supreme Lord is so full that for the deliverance of the conditioned soul, he is the supplier and digester of food, the witness of his activities, the giver of knowledge in the form of the Vedas, as the Supreme Personality of Godhead Sri Krishna, the teacher of the Bhagavad Gita, and he is worshipful by the conditioned soul. Thus God is all good and God is all merciful. It's just such an amazing purport. It goes on. So the truth, when we start to want to find out about ourselves and about our relationship with God, this self-realization or atma-tattva becomes automatic. There's one analogy or one story that's given about Socrates. Socrates was actually a covered bhakta. He was quite, although he didn't come in the Vedic sort of tradition, he was quite an enlightened sort of person. And Socrates had an uneducated slave that was with him. And Socrates, just to prove something, started to question this sage about a mathematical theorem. He didn't tell him what the answer was, but he started questioning him and you know, just directing him really gently, what do you think about this theorem? So now he had no knowledge of him knowing this truth, this mathematical theorem, but he kept provoking him. And then eventually this uneducated, illiterate slave just brought out this mathematical theorem from who knows where. And Socrates then said, this is an understanding that the truth is within us and that we have to be reminded to look for the truth. So in essence, we understand that we have super soul, Krishna as Paramatma, living within this body. We have our real consciousness. And again, in this book that we were reading, there's super consciousness, which is our real identity, real individual jiva soul. We have our consciousness, which is activity, and subconscious. And so we all the truth is there. We're part and parcel of Krishna, so the truth is there. It's just a question of churning it out, bringing it out. And this is what Socrates was saying. The truth is there, but to get to the truth is elusive. And most of the time, people are too afraid to search for the truth. Like, say, for example, these priests and brothers in New Guinea, they were sort of content with their understanding of spirituality. And we see that also in all the varieties of different religions that are around at the moment. People are content with a limited amount of truth and don't want to go any further. There's no more search. There's no more inquisitiveness. And so they are afraid to search. Like, how many times have we had it that if we start to preach to, say, our parents or older members of the community, and they know what you're saying is true, they won't take it. Yeah, you believe that, that's okay. Because they are afraid to take it any further. I remember when we first came to Krishna consciousness, again, you know, talking to my parents, you know, well, you know, isn't it? Yeah, but wait a minute. That sounds true. Do you agree with that? Yes, I agree with that. But we have our set belief and we'll stay with that. So they're not malleable. They're not able to be engrossed into real knowledge. So people are afraid because why? They cling to Maya. They want to cling on to their material attachments. They're keen to eat the fruits of this tree, material tree. They don't want to let go. So, but within us, the Satchidananda, eternality, full knowledge and bliss, is there dormant with all of us. So this truth is within us and ready to be rediscovered. And we have to open ourselves to the truth. So that was the point that we came to in my life personally, that we became open to the truth. It was, in a sense, due to frustration that we came to a point where we said, well, you know, I remember specifically one night, especially sitting up in bed just going, if there's a God, you just have to tell me. After being through all this sort of stuff, you know, the Catholic thing, the Christian thing, this guru, that thing, this thing, reading all sorts of books, Tibetan Book of the Dead, Yogananda, basically just sitting up in bed going, if there's a God, will you for God's sake tell me what I'm supposed to do? And it was only a short period of time after that that the Bhagavatam, picture of Krishna, and then the ball started rolling. You have to put out. And we've all done that in our life. There's come a point where we've opened ourselves up. Okay, just give me the truth. You know, there's that, I don't know if we could, you know, there's that famous quotation, you know, that where, what's his name? Tom Cruise says, I want to know the truth. You know, and Jack Nicholson says, you can't handle the truth. Well, in a sense, We can. We want to know the truth and we can handle the truth. We want the truth. So we have to open ourselves up. And then the Lord's presence is perceived everywhere. We start to see, with a little bit of insight, with a little bit of openness, with a little bit of attentiveness, because you have to be discerning, you have to start analysing, you start to see Krishna literally everywhere. Not that you see a blue boy running around here and there, but you actually start to see this point of Krishna being in every living entity. You see the marvellous way that Krishna creates the whole creation and how beautifully everything works perfectly. But you have to be attentive and you have to be open. When that happens, when you start to see that if you're dealing with somebody, it's not just that individual that you're dealing with, you're also dealing with Krishna residing in the body of that living entity, Krishna residing in the body of that animal or that plant, and so on and so forth. So you have to be open and attentive. What the natural consequence of that is you become incredibly compassionate. How can you not be compassionate if you actually see Krishna residing? Krishna is so compassionate that he is travelling with every living entity, waiting for the living entity, the silent witness, waiting until all those material desires have been burnt out. Okay, are you now finished? Will you now come home with me? That's what Krishna is doing. He's just waiting. He's our friend. Will you now come home with me? Trust me. Sarvadharma Parijagyam. You've got nothing to fear. I'll take care of you. But no, we'll go and eat that little bit of fruit. Just that little bit of fruit. Come on. All right. Here's the fruit. You go for it. Provides everything. And then we have to come back to him. So what happens is when we start to perceive Krishna's compassion, we become compassionate. And we also, as like rubbing the sticks, we want to ignite the fire in other people. And that compassion is a wonderful thing. I just heard a really interesting story recently, you know, with the Dalai Lama coming out. Now we can understand that he to a certain extent, we don't want to lampoon anybody, and he's a good man. He's trying his best with his limited understanding. He's trying his best. He was describing how one of his monks had been kept a prisoner in China for 17 years, right? 17 years this young monk had been kept a prisoner. And he asked him, at any stage, did you feel any danger when you were being held by these captives? And the monk said, he paused for a while and he said, yeah, there was one time that I really felt I was in danger. And so Dalai Lama said, yeah, well, explain, what was it? And he said, I had lost my compassion for my captives, and that was very, very dangerous. That's the attitude when we start to... And another clear example from early Christian understanding, when Jesus was nailed to the cross, I mean, has anybody seen the Passion of the Christ? It was just an account of how Jesus was tortured. And that was actually only partially what they actually did to him from historical records. It's when he's on the cross, you know, the last words he said, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they're doing. So this is understanding the divinity of every living entity. So this compassion starts to develop. So we have to be attentive and open, and that's important to understand divinity. There's a line that we have to cross at one stage. We have to cross the line at one stage. That line is that we have to understand that we are an instrument of Krishna. That we utilize this material world as a servant of Krishna. That everything is in relationship to Krishna. And that's the line. Not that we are here for our own personal satisfaction. It's just a clear-cut line. And in every aspect of our life, we have to remain God-conscious. And we have to attentively and openly see Krishna everywhere. I mean, we're not mood-making, we're not making things up. Attentively and with knowledge and with truth, we have to start to see Krishna everywhere and be compassionate and want to ignite the fire with other people. If we do that, it is to our greatest benefit, and it is the greatest gift we've given. It's not an easy path. Krishna consciousness, bhakti yoga, is not necessarily the easiest of paths, but it is the most rewarding, because the reward that you get is ultimately love of Krishna, prema. And nothing can top that. That's the highest perfection. To be able to love Krishna in full and feel that reciprocation of Krishna's love to you. And that is the greatest perfection. So it's, and no one said it was going to be easy, but there's actually no other choice. You know? So we have to draw the line in the sand that everything that we do is going to be for Krishna and not for my own sense gratification. That's how we should adjust and live our lives. And then the process becomes actually quite nectarian, because we start to understand the truth from within. Things will start to, you know, Chaita Guru from within starts to make things, Guru from without starts to make things real for you. Krishna's presence starts to make things real for you, and slowly, slowly the illusion starts to be dissipated and the truth comes out. So I'll stop here. Has anybody got any questions or comments at all? Yeah, Prabhu.
You said that when you are chanting, you have to hear vibrations.
Yep.
What happens when you are chanting and you hear the vibration? Sometimes you are just drawn to something.
Yep.
So how do you control the mind at that stage?
There's a really interesting thing. There's a book by Mahanidhi Swami about perfecting one's chanting. And in it he mentions that Prabhupada used to say, if there are thoughts coming into your mind, you should supplace them or replace them with positive thoughts. Another thing that Mahanidhi Swami was saying was that when we're chanting, and this is true in any process of meditation, when we chant, the negative things come up to the fore. And it's not surprising that we've all had that. When we're chanting Hare Krishna, chanting our rounds, the weirdest, most, where the hell did that come from thought comes into your mind. And that's quite normal. And Prabhupada actually described that that's actually quite normal. Let it go. Because, what did Prabhupada say? You have to die to live. Bhaktivinoda Thakur said, you have to die to live. So you have to let those negative thoughts go. And simply hear. Just go back to hearing. Hearing and remembering the pastimes of Krishna. There was a really interesting thing that also Mahanidhi Swami wrote in that book, where he says that the chanting of Hare Krishna, the mantra itself, is like a capsule of medicine. The capsule, the outside capsule, is not the mantra. It's the inside that's the medicine, because a capsule can contain medicine or it can contain poison. So it is actually not the sound, the virtual sound of Krishna's name, that is Krishna. It is actually the inside, the heart of it. So when Krishna comes to us when we're chanting, it's not that it comes orally, it comes through the heart, and then it comes to the ears, and then to the tongue, and Krishna dances on our tongue. So when we're chanting, we just have to be very attentive and open and really be mindful that we're hearing correctly, that it is a meditation process. And be aware also that, yeah, there are negative things that are coming in, but in the same token, you let them go. Even when I'm teaching meditation, because, you know, as you know, I'm teaching people as an introduction to Krishna consciousness. A person says, oh, there are so many thoughts that come into my mind. In the old meditation term, we used to say, okay, that's just unstressing. It is like a purging, a cleansing. So when these thoughts come in our meditation, when we're doing japa, you'd let them go. You'd be the silent witness behind that and say, God, check out what the mind is chucking up now. Our mind is our best friend or our worst enemy, but be assured that mind is going to be there for a long, long time, so you better get used to trying to deal with it. And especially during our chanting, we have to somehow or other just make sure that that mind is under control. And that's just simply hearing. There's a whole process Mahanidhi Swami actually lays out 8 different processes, Bhaktivinoda Thakur also did, on how to chant properly. And that is, you know, setting the right place, hearing, there's so many things. And when we apply that process, then you can easily do it. Prabhupada actually said that what pleased Prabhupada most was if we could chant our 16 rounds in one stretch. He said, that's the best. So, if you can, that's great. It's not always possible, but just be mindful that this meditation is our chanting is a meditation, and not to become wrapped up. Understand the thoughts that are coming and allow them to go and go back to hearing and chanting. Oh yeah, there's that thought. You know, we have it so often. Oh, I've got to do this, I've got to do that, I've got to paint that painting, I've got to drop this off here, I've got to see him, I've got to pick up some money. You have to be open and attentive. Open, allowing the mantra to come in. Attentive, saying, hang on, that can come later. Just switch off that mind. And it'll come back again, and back again, and back again. Like I said, the process of bhakti yoga isn't easy, but it's the best. Is that clear? Yes, no, yeah, whoever.
Okay.
Yes, Prabhu.
In connection to this chanting process, to avoid negative thoughts while chanting, now what I prefer, that I chant in the temple hall.
Yep.
Or maybe in the temple campus. While chanting, I try to think about Krishna and Prabhupada. But during that process also, I am not hearing mantra properly.
Yep.
Attentively. So, is that good way or?
Anything that you can do to, you know, put you into a spiritual atmosphere is good. But technically speaking, all you simply have to do is pronounce the holy name properly. It's just that pronunciation. Bhakti Churu Maharaj, when he was here, he gave that perfect understanding of chanting Hare Krishna. You know how Prabhupada often says, you know, you just have to be like a child crying out for mother. My dear Lord, please engage me in your service. So that mood has to be engendered. But Bhakti Churu Maharaj was saying, when we're chanting, really, and it made such a difference to me, when we're chanting, all we really have to do is just think, feel within ourselves, Krishna, I love you. Krishna, I love you. You know, if you say that, you know, when a husband and wife or boyfriend and girlfriend, when you say, I love you, it has such strength. How often do we say that to the person that's right here within our heart, who loves us so much, more than any husband or wife could ever, any child could ever? He loves us so much. If we then in turn turn around to him and say, Krishna, I love you, openly and attentively, think about what you're saying or what you're feeling from the heart. If we're parrot fashion, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, hasn't much effect. When it comes from the heart, if you start the process of meditation, start the process of japa with this understanding, Krishna, I love you. I want to come close to you. I want to be with you. And then start the mantra, you know, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Then it becomes so, that's a strong meditation. And you'll experience it, you know. So it's just that simple practice will help you enormously, help me enormously.
So that means we should help only one thought.
As best as possible. You know, the mind is capable of having many, many thoughts. You know, when we're in an environment surrounded by devotees, you're thinking, oh, he's here, oh, she's here, oh, he's a good devotee, she's a good devotee, you know. That's good. Oh, Prabhupada's there. I wonder what clothes the deities are wearing. That's fine. There are always thoughts. Better having that thought than having a thought, you know, oh, I want to eat a cream pie, or gee, she looks good, and so on and so forth. Which could be if you're out there. So you, first of all, you've put yourself into an environment which is conducive to chanting. Whether that's here at the temple or at home. Make your home a temple. Make one room in your home a temple. So you hit that room and you think, oh, I can't think those sort of thoughts here. I can't think about my paintings or about work and stuff. This is Krishna's room here, you know. So, gee, yeah, the deities look nice, or picture of Prabhupada looks great, and like that. So you set up the environment. So there are many thoughts going in your mind, but then you come back with attentiveness and openness, and you localize it. What am I here for? I'm here to re-establish my connection with Krishna. I'm here to validate or to give strength to Krishna, saying, I want to love you. I want to know you. I want to get out. I want to stop eating these fruits of the material forest. No more fruits from the material forest. You know? So if you have that attitude, then you'll chant good rounds. Sintra, is that okay for me?
Yeah.
Mataji? Is that right? Okay. So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki.